Welcome back, Health Bite community. We are edging into the middle of June and summer is officially around the corner, a time that we typically associate with pause, although many of us no longer do. For most of us, downtime is non-existent these days, and it seems that the only way to achieve it is to literally engineer pause into our lives. With all the data correlating rest with brain health, cognitive health, and emotional well-being, it seems like creating downtime is a worthwhile effort. Cooking for ourselves seems like a perfect excuse to do just that. While many of us view cooking as a time-consuming chore, it is an opportunity for pause, for mindfulness, and for showing ourselves some attention and care. As I head into my own pause for the summer, I'm re-releasing a conversation I had with intuitive cooking specialist Claire Materne. Listen in as we talk about the power of cooking as a form of mindfulness, self-care, and for pause. Hi, this is Dr. Adrian. Welcome to Health Bite, the podcast where we explore all things health and wellness. Good morning and welcome to Health Bite. I'm so happy today to be here with Claire Materne. Claire is a chef, a food writer who specializes in intuitive cooking, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about her practice and practices that we can engage in for better health and wellness. So welcome, Claire. Glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So I like to start with, how people kind of entered this area, this arena of health and wellness. How did you get interested in this area and come to do what you're doing right now?
Yeah. So I grew up in the food industry. So it's definitely been a lifelong practice for me. But what I realized in my mid to late 20s was when seeing and hearing all the problems that friends of mine had with feeling overwhelmed with cooking, not even knowing how to go shopping, not knowing what to buy, how to buy things, hearing stories of, I bought spinach because it's supposed to be good for you, but then I didn't know what to do with it and it went bad. It's like, okay, well, first of all, you could have done anything with that. So for me, growing up in food and knowing how to approach it in that intuitive way, like using your senses, made me realize that I guess it isn't the way that a lot of people are able to experience food and cooking. So that was the real driver for me of, okay, let's break this down. Let's start thinking about how cooking and buying food really becomes part of your everyday lifestyle and how that becomes part of, health and wellness in the sense that it's your mental health, your physical health, you're fully integrated with your life.
It's funny, isn't it, that food is like the, it's like not even cliche. It seems silly to even say that it is the primary way in which we nourish ourselves, right?
Exactly.
And yet we've really taken it for granted, in our desire to be expedient. We kind of don't feel like we should or need to spend any time to cook. I mean, we know we have to spend time to shower and get ready in the mornings. We know we have to spend time to get our children ready and, send them off to school or whatever the case may be. But we have engineered time away and out of our lives for food and our nutrition.
100%. The way that you just hit that nail on the head is what I hear all the time. And I mean, just the idea that, people complain about the fact that they have to cook. That's always been such a thing for me of how do we change that inner dialogue with ourselves or monologue with ourselves about how we approach food, which is instead of complaining that it's a chore that you have to do, it's changing it to being something that we get to celebrate that we get to do it. Because exactly what you said, we're nourishing ourselves. You get to make these choices.
In people's defense, to your point, we don't know what to do. We haven't maybe been modeled that, mm-hmm. A lot of us are either children of immigrants in which food was so essential that mothers were spending hours in the kitchen. And that's not doable for any of us, no. even if we
even if we're interested in cooking, or we were parent, those same parents were those who were working and managing the home at the same time. And so they were forced to be expedient.
Exactly.
And so I think people are intimidated by how to manage their food. And then of course, the universe has made it easy for us to just pick things up quickly or to eat out. But something interesting really happened with COVID, and you probably saw this in your clients as well, is that, I mean, obviously people weren't eating out as much and or couldn't eat out as much. And what I saw in my medical practice is that things like blood pressure that we were managing with multiple agents immediately resolved just because of the sodium reduction in not eating out. Even salads, you know, we take for granted the fact that salads out there are made to be yummy, and they're not made in the best well-intentioned way.
Well, that's exactly it. People have had to cook more. Probably, you know, even I, you know, we all kind of hit the cooking exhaustion. But what I think was kind of a silver lining of right now is seeing how integrated it can become in life. Because once you see how to manage things and make easy dinners that aren't going to take a long, long time, and you get to see what you're putting in, and so that you can control the saltiness, like, or anything. What I always tell people too is, you know, cooking is such a tactile experience. You're reaching in for those pinches of salt. You're actually seeing how much you're putting in, and then it's relating to what you're tasting. Because, you know, they always say, you know, salt to taste. And then while you're doing it, you're actually learning then, oh, okay, two pinches of salt equates what that tastes like, and that's enough for me. So that when you start going out, or when you buy bottled products, you actually realize how salty those things are, or how sugary those things are, because you've created that new baseline for yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're kind of edging into I think this concept of intuitive eating, which is your domain, right? So
totally.
Can you first explain what that even means? What is intuitive eating?
Yeah, so intuitive eating and then intuitive cooking, which goes so hand in hand in the way that I've always cooked and now am showing how to cook, is that sensory experience. You know, it's the idea of really listening to your body, listening to your gut. I always say, you know, you listen to your gut to feed it. We've got this, all our senses, including a bonus one called common sense, which is that gut instinct of ours that we always forget to listen to. And especially in the kitchen, I think we almost like are deaf to our own body when we go into the kitchen. We're so fearful of it. But if you just tap into being present, to knowing that this is what you're doing in that moment, you're listening to what you want, what you're craving, you know, if something smells really good to you, most likely you want that carrot that smells so sweet and delicious. You know, you're honing in on what you want in that moment, and then using your body and employing the senses that we all have to create that meal for yourself.
So I want to get real here for a minute, because I grapple with this concept of intuitive eating a little bit, because I wonder how people can distinguish intuitive eating or listening to your body versus following a craving. So, you know, like whenever I have a heavy meal at night, and I tend to not want to do that, but if I have a heavy meal, I immediately want to add insult to injury by having something sweet. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I will like ravage every cabinet to find something sweet. And so how is that not intuitive, like eating ice cream on top of a heavy, decadent pasta dish?
True. Yeah.
How do you differentiate that?
I mean, that's definitely something hard. And yeah, I think we've all been guilty to those moments, and especially in lockdown. That's definitely been something that I've done. I think what the way to distinguish that, at least the way that I've always tried to apply it in my own life, is that in that moment, is it that you cannot, you're all consumed by the idea of ice cream and you won't be satisfied without anything but that ice cream? Or is it that a lot of times too, is it just that you're almost eating out of boredom, or that you know, it's almost like a fixation that you need? So could that be remedied by some fruit or a cup of peppermint tea? You know, is there, how is that just, you know, is it that you need like a nice ending to the meal, or is it that you are like so fixated on that ice cream and figuring out how you can remedy that either by having ice cream and not having three scoops, but like a small scoop in a nice little bowl, or can you do it by something else?
Yeah, I think it is pretty nuanced, right? And two things that I think you mentioned that I want to expand on is, one, the habitualness of it. So I think that, at least in my mind, that craving comes from this like memory or a habitual process that if I'm at a restaurant and I eat something really big, it's in those moments that it's followed by dessert. In my day-to-day life, I don't do that. And so there is this kind of mental memory that we get. And so it's a habituation. And I think the second thing you bring up is really, how do you allow desire to pass, right? Because desire is an emotion like every other emotion. And when it comes to my patients, sometimes I give this analogy. It's like walking down, I don't know, Rodeo Drive, and you see this Gucci bag or shoes, and you're like, I have to have those shoes. But of course, you keep on walking. And even though in that moment, that feeling of desire is so intense, it passes. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 minutes later, chances are you're not thinking about those shoes. So it's the ability to acknowledge that feeling and not get over attached to it and let it pass.
Totally. I think that's completely it. I also think so much of it too is, and you know, I apply this to my own self, and then when I speak about preparing food and cooking too, is I never want to deny myself anything, and I never want to deny what you are choosing for yourself. And I think too, so much of that can become almost like a dangerous like loop, and then you can't have anything but that ice cream until you have that ice cream. So part of me is like, so just have a little ice cream then, right? Because once you say that you can't, that's when you want it even more,
right? It's that it's the negating that drives the compulsion that you
exactly
were talking about.
Yeah.
You know, I think another important point to bring up is that, you know, how you bring up a point of moderation, right? And when you're in the moment, I don't think I have ever finished, we're talking ice cream, a cup of ice cream and been like, okay, I couldn't have more. I think I could always have more, you know? But I think part of me can recall or can stay aligned with how I feel, not just in that moment of eating something decadent, but how I feel later. And I'm not talking about guilt or shame or anything like that. I'm talking about physically how I feel if I'm too full, or yep, physically how I feel when I get in a food coma, right? Mm-hmm. I don't feel good. Or the next morning if I eat too late. So part of that intuition is not only being in that moment and getting that dopamine hit, but staying aligned, like let's follow this path and staying aligned with how the long-term experience is and using that as a guide.
Completely. I think not only is it that, but it's also the idea too of, when you're in that moment with your food, to actually be in that moment with your food. And I know, you know, all of us are guilty, and I certainly am, you know, especially right now where, you know, you're putting on the series that you're following on Netflix or HBO and you're eating and you almost forget that you're eating. You know, you're just doing it. But to actually be in the moment of enjoying what you're on your plate, you know, making little bites of taking a bite of, you know, the vegetables that you've made and the mashed potatoes and a little of the roast chicken, you know, whatever it is, it's putting yourself in that present moment of enjoying. And especially if you've then cooked that meal as well, you've prepared your body for the sense that for the action of eating it, you know, I feel like too, there's such a separation of when we order out or when we go to a restaurant, because we're not preparing it, your body is just like, oh, suddenly there's food in front of me. But when you're making it, you're getting ready, you know, you're revving up. It's almost like you're stretching, you're warming up to the fact that you're going to be enjoying what you're making. So you're seeing it all you're touching it all, you're smelling it all, and then you get to eat it all. And it creates that through line, like you said too, of feeling 100% present with the action of eating.
And I like how you bring up the point that, you know, even though this is something you teach, it's not necessarily, it's something that takes practice, right?
100%.
I was listening to this podcast by Lori Santos. She's a Yale professor that offered a course on the science of happiness. And she talks about all the ways in which, you know, scientifically, naturally, we can enhance our happiness. And what she says is that even though we know these things, we still have to practice them. So
exactly.
It's okay to not be perfect in it and to know that those of us who talk about it aren't perfect in it either. We just practice it. And through practice, we become better.
Right. Of course. I mean, I feel like if the idea of being perfect is the thing that's holding you back, then there's no such thing as a practice, because to do anything is to practice. You know, if you're perfect there, you know, there is no such thing as perfect, because that would stop you from ever doing something.
And it's sabotage.
You're self-sabotaging from the get-go. You know, I have to remind myself, you know, I do a meditation practice and I'm constantly reminded by the sense that there is no such thing as a perfect meditation, or there's no such thing as a bad meditation, because it's the practice of doing it. So even though you feel like you maybe didn't go deep enough into the meditation and your mantra, or you were scatterbrained, that doesn't matter, because you did it. And that's always what I want to tell people too, you know, really, what's the worst thing that can happen when you cook? I think that's the fear is what holds us back from even trying doing that practice, because they think it'll be inedible. Bottom line is, it probably won't be. You might make a mistake. You might burn something. You might have to start over. But like, if we're talking like the worst thing that could happen would be like you ruined it and it's like black, fine, don't do that next time. That was a practice you learned. Because otherwise, what's actually the worst thing that could happen?
So let's get concrete a little bit, because I'm sure for maybe people who are listening, it sounds all wooey and pretty to talk about it conceptually.
Yeah.
But you have a friend or a client that comes to you and says, I don't know what to do with the spinach. Or let's start even before that. My fridge is always empty because I never cook. But I'm interested, I hear you, and I want to get engaged in this process. What's the first step?
So the first step would be to learn your grocery store, I think, too. Like, so many people are scared to go shopping. And I think, obviously, you know, depending on, you know, if you're online shopping, fine, whatever. I'm a very tactile person, so I do encourage people to go into stores. You want to be able to see things, touch things, smell things. But get to know your grocery store and get to know the basics that you like to eat. Because also, like, if you're going to buy things because someone told you to buy things and then you don't actually like them, you're never going to use it. So don't go out and get every spice that someone tells you to buy. Buy spices that you know you like, taste, try, smell. And it's all, again, it's putting into practice the idea of experimentation. And so get vegetables that you like, try new things. Definitely leave your comfort zone. If you always buy kale because kale is so popular, but you've never had Swiss chard, buy Swiss chard. You can use it the exact same way. You can do anything with it, basically. You cut it up, you can saute it, you can steam it, you can throw it on a sheet pan and put it in the oven. But just try something new that time. Then next week, try a different vegetable if you want. Or buy Swiss chard because you really liked it, and a new vegetable. Or try different proteins. You know, if you've never really been a fish eater, start with a mild fish like a hake or a cod, you know, a nice flaky white fish. Work your way up and just get to know what you like, because then you'll start using it and then you'll get to experiment with it.
What are some pantry items that you think are must-haves for people who are initiating a cooking practice at home?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, definitely like shelf staples, like pantry staples that also will never go bad. Always have some dried beans. Have canned beans too, and canned lentils if you want. But dried beans are going to last forever. They take a little bit of planning because you have to soak them overnight, or you can do a quick blanch before you cook them for like 10 minutes. But you can use them for anything then. You can cook them up a big batch and use them differently throughout the week. So, and they're a great source of protein. So I definitely recommend beans. Canned, rice and pastas. You can have gluten-free. All these things too fit into whatever specific diet you might need to do for your lifestyle. But choose what you like. There's so many great different kinds of pastas on the market now in different shapes. Choose what you like.
Grains are great too to that end. And they exactly. Just like the beans, they last. So you can make a cup of or a bowl of farro or quinoa or oats.
Or barley or kamut. I mean, there's so many cool grains on the market. So many different kinds of rice. You know, there's black rice and red rice and brown rices and jasmine rice. And you can have short grain rice if you want to be able to do like risottos or more like stewy things with it. You could have long grain rices. And again, too, like they really do last. A lot of these things are quite cheap, especially to buy in bulk. And then you just keep them in airtight containers.
And easy to cook, right? I mean, you just like boil water and throw it in or vegetable stock or chicken stock that can also be purchased and throw it in.
Exactly.
What I suggest to people when it comes to grains and beans is most people know how to make a salad, right? So they're making a salad and they can cook their protein or they can get their protein, you know, cooked, like get a rotisserie chicken, buy already grilled chicken.
Yep, perfect.
And then start by adding maybe that grain, a cup of that grain into your salad.
Exactly.
And then once you've done that, you can, from there, break the ice and start mixing different spices or herbs, right? Different herbs.
And you can even do, you can make like little salads that could then be, like I do say that salad's my favorite food. And every time I say that, again, I roll. But what I love about salads is it's a blank canvas. So you just, you've got exactly what you said. You have the greens that you can put grain and bean on, or you can make a bean salad. You know, I love like chickpeas with parsley and a little celery and, you know, cilantro or chives, any herbs with olive oil. Have that sitting in your fridge. Eat that by itself. Maybe add a little tuna to it or a canned salmon, which is really easy as well. Or use that as a topper on your green salad or grain bowl. You know, all these things start working together like puzzle pieces.
And so how and where, I mean, you have a lot of great recipes on your website, but, you know, again, when we're trying to be practical about how people can do this in a efficient way, do you recommend people looking up recipes beforehand? How do you suggest they go about decision-making?
Yeah, well, so much of it, actually, that ties into the idea of intuitive cooking then too, is my dream in the world is that people would never have to feel tied to a recipe to actually doing it. I understand the idea of recipes as great inspiration and ideas. So I'd say, you know, if it's on my site or my Instagram or if it's Pinterest board or if you have a favorite blog or books that you like to peek through, do that as idea collectors. But don't ever feel like you have to be tied to every single step that is written down in a recipe, because that's where the intuition of when you're in the kitchen. And what I like to say, then you get to call, you play this game that I call kitchen improv. So if someone talks about needing a certain spice for the chicken that you're going to roast up and then use differently, but you don't have that, but you've got, you know, X number of other spices, do that. You know, there's no reason why you have to chain yourself to a recipe. Or if you've got, like I just said, the chickpeas, you know, if you read a recipe for a chickpea salad with celery and mixed herbs, but you only have white kidney beans, or, you know, black kidney beans or like a white Berlotti bean, that shouldn't stop you from doing that salad. It's going to still be delicious. It looks different. It's going to taste different, but it's the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point, because even for me personally, and I like to cook, when I look at a recipe and I see all the different steps and ingredients, sometimes that's where I get intimidated and get tripped up. Totally. And a lot of times, I mean, you can't take away an essential ingredient, like if you need oil for your skillet, right?
Right, exactly.
But there's a lot of things that you can take out and it's not necessarily going to negatively affect your recipe, or you can swap, right? One herb for another.
Exactly. And that's where the tasting comes in too, because if you don't have an herb or you don't like that herb, but you know, you've tasted another herb, that's when using that sense goes, oh, I've got this, I can add that in. you know, and it'll continue to build on that flavor.
And what about essential items? So are there any gadgets or items that you think are absolutely necessary to start cooking before you start cooking?
I think what's great is that it actually doesn't take that much. A really good knife is going to be key. You know, like a classic 8-inch chef's knife. I'd say you really only need 3 knives in your life if you aren't going to be doing a ton. You need an 8-inch chef's knife, a serrated knife for bread, tomatoes, citrus is really good for that too, and a little paring knife. And then you're good. Have a couple cutting boards, wooden, plastic, either one for you. A couple skillets, a couple like small saucepans. If you had like 2 skillets, 2 saucepans, your 3 knives, you know, I have a small New York kitchen. That's really all you need. You know, that's kind of basics.
I'm going to throw in my favorite, which is a grill plate that I use constantly. You can get it on, well, anywhere. You can get it anywhere online.
Totally.
And throw it on your stove. And that is a very easy, non-intimidating way to make chicken tenders, veggies, even fish. You just throw it on the grill plate. You can use spray, right? And mm-hmm. Because you can't really put oil on that thing or a lot of oil. And so it is a low calorie and very easy way, quick way, you know, for those of us who are working. And again, we do have to be mindful of time.
Totally.
The grill plate is a great gadget to have.
I 100% agree with you. I have a cast iron grill pan, does the same thing, which I don't even add oil to or spray to, because if you get it up to a really high heat, you're fine.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I want to circle back and end with talking a little bit about what we started talking about, which was the mindfulness during and presence during eating, and specifically how is that done? So in the first place, we talked about preparing your meal. And how by preparing your meal, smelling, tasting, touching the ingredients, you are preparing your body, your mind to be in that moment and ready, available for the food. So that's one way to build, or the first way maybe to build presence. But then once you have your plate, what are some suggestions that you give people?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it even comes down to the serving. You know, I think celebrating the fact that you've done this meal for yourself should be, you know, take that extra 30 seconds to plate it. You know, eating is so visual as well. You know, we see this nice plate full of colors, full of all these new great vegetables that you're trying out. And so choose a nice plate your food, and then it's about really enjoying every bite. And that's where I feel like, especially when you've gotten to the point where you have fun experimenting different flavors and everything, and you think about how everything is sitting on the plate together, that's when you can curate the bites. You know, you have a little bit of your chicken with a little bit of your vegetable, and then maybe another bite is a little bit of chicken with a little bit of your starch, and then maybe you've got all 3 in one bite, or vegetables and starch. You can have fun really enjoying what you're doing with that food as you're eating.
And that's a huge part of feeling full. I mean, a lot of times when I'm dealing with patients, the issue is not feeling full after a meal or not feeling satisfied, but it's really hard to be satisfied if we're not really paying attention to what we're eating, right? Because you've been 100%. Watching the YouTube on your phone or whatever the case may be, and then the next thing you know, it's gone. So it's hard to, you know, have really enjoyed and been satisfied by that food.
And you eat it faster, and then you don't even realize that you've had, and then you overeat because you go get more. You can correct me, but isn't it something about 15 to 20 minutes is the time it actually takes for the communication from your stomach to your brain?
Right. And so our gut releases a bunch of hormones when it sees and senses food that signals to the brain, woohoo, I got some, we're good down here. Yep. Right. And yeah. And that process takes about 20 minutes. So I think the big message really is, once again, that you know, we get it. We're all busy. You're a busy cook entrepreneur in New York. I'm a busy mom, doc, and also entrepreneur, having started our new business, Del Nutrition. And time is a premium. but we have to negotiate sometime. We don't have to be Martha Stewart is the example I always use, right? We don't have to be in the kitchen 24/7, but we do have to acknowledge that some time is necessary in order to make this what it deserves, right? The experience that it needs to be.
Completely. And I think it's reminding yourself that you are the center of it and that you deserve to have a good meal. And it doesn't have to look Instagram perfect. It doesn't have to look like Martha Stewart has created, you know, it's not going into the pages of a magazine, but it's that you are putting yourself first and that you deserve and you have the self-respect to make that little extra time for yourself. And that it's tasting good and it's nourishing you no matter what it looks like.
I like that. That's definitely a message of empowerment that you deserve to feed yourself well.
Definitely. And food should be empowering. That's all. That's what it comes down to. It's you're doing it for yourself and your loved ones. And that's empowering.
Well, I love the conversation and the tips that you provided. Is there, can you share with us your social handles and where we can find out more about you?
Yeah. So I'm just at Claire Matern, basically everywhere, and ClaireMatern.com. So
and you have,
find me.
You have yummy recipes and videos. I'm looking at it right now so that you can give people some more concrete advice around what we talked about. So
exactly. And the videos I hope show how easy it is to actually do things. Remember that it's easier than you always think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Claire. I enjoyed having you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode is sponsored by Del Bar. Del Bar by Del Nutrition is a high protein, low calorie bar created with clean nutrients to support you in healthy weight, health, and well-being. My patients love these bars, and I would love to share them with you. Go to delnutrition.com and sign up for our newsletter there. I hope it will serve you and it will be of benefit.